All you introverts. So we're carrying on in our series in the Gospel of Matthew, and just as a heads up, we'll be in Matthew 17. In one of C.S. Lewis's books, in the Chronicles of Narnia, The Silver Chair, a young prince named Rillian is held captive by this enchantress who seeks to erase his memory and keep him from fulfilling his destiny. She convinces him and others that the world outside of her underworld doesn't exist, that the sun, Aslan, Narnia, they're just illusions. And he's even strapped to this silver chair each night, which is the only time when he remembers who he truly is. And the great climax of this story is when those who come to rescue Prince Rillian are forced to wrestle with whether the stories they believed about rescue are real or if they're just made up. That tension in the book is so relatable. Many of us are tempted to believe, or already believe, that help for the brokenness of this world is impossible. We'll witness injustice and evil all around us, in our world, in our city, like in moments like last week on Saturday night. And something within us rightfully aches. We feel this tension that there is no rescue. There is no hope. This is all there is. We don't just grieve injustice or feel anger at evil. We carry this crushing burden of an idea that nothing has changed and nothing will change. We're like Prince Rillian and the heroes who've come to save him. We're being persuaded to believe that a good world does not exist, that this world was not made good, that there's no resolution, and that even hoping for one is foolish. Just like in the silver chair, there are these forces at work eager to persuade us to forget who Jesus says we are, to forget what he has done and is doing in our world. But here's the thing, our longings for justice, for peace, and wholeness, they're not foolish desires. They're these deep signposts pointing to a truer story, that things weren't always like this and weren't meant to stay this way and will not stay this way. The gospel of Jesus Christ tells us that there's this powerful moment in Matthew's gospel that points us to the hope that God has and is doing something to make things right. It's just not in the way we expect. So I want to invite us to go to Matthew chapter 17, starting in verse 1. Matthew 17, starting in verse 1. We'll read all the way through to verse 13. This is what it says. And after 6 days, Jesus took him, Peter, and James, and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good that we're here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, Rise and have no fear. And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw that no one but Jesus only. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, Tell no one the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And the disciples asked him, Why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? And he answered, Elijah does come, and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come. And they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. Father in heaven, we thank you for your Son, Jesus. That he is this picture and invitation to experience fullness of life and hope. Is your declaration that you have not abandoned creation and that you have come to put things right. So as you say in this text, Help us hear him. We want to listen to him. And it's in his name we pray. Amen. Okay, so what's happening in this passage? What's happening at this transfiguration? This passage comes on the heels of an event right before in the verses that precede it. It's where Peter confesses that Jesus is the Messiah, the Christ, the long-awaited King of God, this anointed one who would bring God's good, just, and peaceful reign on earth. It's the restorative reign of God coming to earth. Jesus affirms that Peter didn't come to this conclusion just on his own, but rather by divine revelation, that his Father in heaven has revealed this to him. And then he tells Peter, yeah, I am Israel's long-awaited king, but I'm not the king you're expecting. I have come to lay down my life as a ransom for many, and after 3 days I will rise again. Now, Peter and the disciples, they don't understand what he's talking about. And so they reject this idea, and Peter's like, no, I'll never let that happen. And Jesus explains, if anyone's going to follow me, they too must pick up their cross. In other words, if you want to follow me, you have to let me lead. You're not in the driver's seat, so don't run from suffering. Embrace it. My way is the way of self-sacrifice. Follow me. I'll show you how. That's really important because the transfiguration of Jesus is what follows that event. Think about this. For 6 days, Peter and the other disciples would have been processing. So Jesus is the Christ. He is the King. But he says he will suffer and die and rise. Jesus says if we want to follow him as the King, we need to embrace a life of self-sacrifice and suffering. Why would the Messiah suffer? He's supposed to overcome our enemies, defeat them. Why is he telling us we need to pick up a cross? Why would we even seek that out? Now, 6 days after that moment, we get a foretaste of what follows self-sacrifice, what follows laying down your life. Self-sacrifice is followed by this new life. One scholar explains this. The transfiguration, coming as it does here after the bleak predictions of rejection, emphasizes the link between self-sacrifice and glorious vindication in the economy of the God who reigns and yet suffers. There's this connection between self-sacrifice and the glory that is to come. Now Jesus takes Peter and James and John up on this mountain. And what happens there is unlike anything that they've ever seen. So much of what Matthew describes here is elusive. It's alluding to more of the story of God. And if you're familiar with it, you catch it. If you're not as familiar, you'll be like, why is this significant? So let me just walk through a little bit of that. Jesus is transfigured, meaning his glory is revealed. This is more than just what Peter does 6 days earlier when he says, you are the Christ. This is Peter, James, and John seeing with their own eyes Jesus' true nature, who he is, the Son of God, that he's radiant, divine, lit up, that the light of the world here reveals his true nature. And he is not alone. There's Moses and Elijah there. Two towering figures of Israel's story appear and speak with Jesus. These two are these ultimate representatives of the law in Moses and the prophets in Elijah. And they are talking to the one who says he has come to fulfill all that both the law and the prophets looked forward to. Both Moses and Elijah, they left life in really unique, uncanny ways. Moses, his body was never found, and Elijah was taken up in a chariot of fire. But more than that, both of these figures were connected to the end of time. There was this expectation that a prophet would arise in the last days like Moses. And in Deuteronomy 17, Moses tells Israel, he says, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your fellow Israelites. And then he says, you must listen to him. Sounds a lot like the voice from the cloud, what it declares, what he declares. Similarly, there was this expectation within the Old Testament that Elijah would return before the end of time. Now he is here talking with Jesus. And then there's this cloud and the voice from heaven. And it shoots you back to different moments in Israel's story. One of them we just read about in Matthew 3 at Jesus' baptism. when heaven opens up and the Spirit of God descends like a dove on Jesus at his baptism, and a voice from heaven says, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." Now we have this other moment, a bright cloud that overshadows them, and a voice, God the Father, declaring, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." So both in Elijah's and Moses' encounters with God, they have moments where they fall down in awe before God on mountains. Moses on Mount Sinai, Elijah on Mount Carmel. Carmel, not caramel. Caramel's good, but it's not what we're talking about. Now, in the passage here, we read that Peter, James, and John fall down on a mountain as the glory of Jesus is revealed and as God the Father overshadows them and declares, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I'm well pleased. Listen to him." So what's going on here? It's not hard to tell that Matthew is saying this moment that Peter, James, and John witness is this moment that is pointing to all of the hopes that Israel had of God's promise to come and make things right in our world, that he is faithful to it, and all of these different things that had been pointing to it, the law, the prophets. God the Father is like, "This is my Son. Listen to him." What's the last thing that he has told his people in the Gospel of Matthew? He's saying, "Look, if you're going to follow me, you need to pick up your cross. Follow me. I'll show you the way. I am the Christ, and I've come to lay down my life. And after 3 days, I will rise." And they don't get that. And here now, 6 days later, the Father's saying, "Listen to him. This is my Son." This is a sign of what God has done, but it's also a sign of what he's doing, that he's come to do something about the brokenness in our world. It's this, the transfiguration is this powerful reminder that God has not remained distant or passive. In Jesus, God has come near. The transfiguration is this foretaste or a preview of what it looks like when heaven invades earth. Jesus isn't just offering a way out of this world. He's beginning to make this one new. This vision of glory isn't just escapism, it's hope. Jesus reveals that God is actively working to put the world right, that salvation is more than our souls just ascending to heaven, but it's about heaven coming to earth, that ache that we have for justice, for healing, for peace, for restoration is not naive. It's real, and it's answered in Jesus, the Christ. Yes, the Son of Man will suffer and die, but after 3 days, he will rise again. And he does, and he enters into the glory of his kingdom. And that's Bible talk for, "I've come to deal with sin, with injustice, with evil, and it won't be all at the end of time. I'm starting now. I'm bringing about a new creation. There's a new beginning for humanity, for the world, because of me and what I'm doing." And so when we're tempted to believe that there's no rescue, that there's no hope, that nothing has changed or ever will change, we can really easily relate to the words of the psalmist in Psalm 94 that read, "How long, Lord, will the wicked? How long will the wicked be jubilant? They pour out arrogant words. All the evildoers are full of boasting. They crush your people, Lord. They oppress your inheritance. They slay the widow and the foreigner. They murder the fatherless. They say, the Lord doesn't see." Psalm 35 similarly cries out, "How long, Lord, will you look on? All that is evil, it feels like there's this brokenness that is unaddressed." But then it adds this request, "Lord, you've seen this. Do not be silent. Do not be far from me, Lord." And our passage this morning is a reminder from God that he has heard, that God sees and has not been silent, that he's not far, he has come near, that he's spoken to us through his Son, hence the invitation, the call to listen to him. He's done something through his Son. And if we're honest with one another, it's really easy to forget this. It's easy to live by sight alone, by what we see. Our thoughts, our heart, get burdened by what we read on social media, what we watch on our devices, what we read on our chosen sources of authority for world events. And it's easy to become, or sorry, it's easy to lose sight of what God has done and is doing in our world. And so one of the questions that we need to ask is, how do we become a people who carry hope into a hurting world? How do we become people who carry that hope that mobilizes into this compassionate action? How can we become people who resist being persuaded by lies that there is no hope, that nothing has changed or ever will change, and the ensuing burden of fear? I think that this moment in our passage, this transfiguration, points to three imperatives that can transform us and enable us to overcome lies and evil with truth. So I want to walk through those. And the very first one we see from God the Father, what he says in verse 5. He says, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." The disciples have struggled to understand Jesus' call to lay down their lives in order to follow him. They fail to see how it connects to God's plan to rescue and renew the world. And the voice from heaven says, "This is my Son. Listen to him." God's command is simple. Listen to Jesus. Not just hear, but pay attention. It's more than that. In the Bible, listening and doing are two sides of the same coin. Listening is intrinsically connected to obedience and trust in God. Yes, hear him. Yes, pay attention, but realize God is after far more than just your auditory perception that he has spoken. It's him looking for this responsive and faithful action to what he says. And we all get this. How many times did your parents say to you, "Listen to me"? How many times have you as a parent said, "Listen to me"? And they're not actually saying, "I want you to make sure that the sounds that are coming out of my mouth enter your ears and you perceive them." That's not what they're getting at. They're saying something more. They're saying, "Respect and do what I'm saying. Respect and do what I've asked you to do. Listen to me." That's what God is saying, minus the frustration that parents normally have when they say it. Listen to him. Receive Jesus' words. Let Jesus' words shape you. Give ear and consider what Jesus says and does. Fill your mind and heart with his words, his actions, his life. Jesus is God's message to us. Everything God wanted to say to us in a person. That's how my son's storybook Bible puts it. God's message to us. Everything God wanted to say to us in a person. Fill your mind with his words. What words? Let me just give some examples. He says, a shepherd has 100 sheep and he loses one. So he leaves the 99 to find the one, searching high and low for that one lost sheep. Finally, he finds it, and when he does, he rejoices. That is the Father's heart for one person who turns to him. A poor woman has 10 coins and she loses one. She looks all over the house, and when she finds it, she rejoices. That joy, that kind of joy, is the joy that my Father has when one person turns to him. No one is worthless. No one is worthless to him. A father loses a son to pride, arrogance, and selfishness. For years, he's estranged from him and the rest of the family. Until one day, out of the blue, the son returns penniless, embarrassed, and repentant. What does the father do? He runs to the son, hugs him, calls everyone around, and announces a feast on that day. Why? Because my son was lost, but is now found. My son was dead, but now alive. That's how the Father responds to anyone who turns back to him. If you look at the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus shows us what it is like when you come into contact with him and begin to follow him. So what's in the Sermon on the Mount? Well, it starts off with the Beatitudes, famously known for their very first word they start with, blessed. But the Beatitudes, they're not blessings you receive for something you produce. They are pictures of what happened when you come into contact with him. So, blessed are those who hunger and thirst to be rightly related to God, others, themselves, the earth. Why? Why? Because those who find they care about being rightly related and encounter me discover my ability to reconcile even the greatest of enemies. That in me, right relationships can become the norm. Blessed are those who are merciful. That is, blessed are those who don't give someone what they deserve when they wrong them, but give them what they don't deserve. Why? Because mercy is the basis of entry into my kingdom. How do you think you enter into my kingdom? Through my mercy. All who entered did so because I was merciful to them, and they get it, so they give mercy to others. He'll say, you are the light of the world. In John's gospel, though, we read that Jesus says, I am the light of the world. In the Sermon on the Mount, his disciples are the light of the world. John's gospel, I am the light of the world. Which one is it? Someone get mixed up? Scribal error? It's both. Because when you come into contact with him, he changes you. He makes his home in you. So you become the light of the world. Light enables others to see things as they are. Light provides you with the ability to see where you need to go. Light shines on the darkness, pushing it back. Light is what supports life and flourishing. That is what you are. Not who you will be or who you need to be. You are the light of the world, so live in light of that. His teachings are full of wisdom and truth. He alone has the words of life. And they aren't just meant to be these nice teachings or nice, insightful ideas to try out. Listen to him. As Dallas Willard puts it in The Divine Conspiracy, Jesus is not just nice, he's brilliant. He is the smartest man who has ever lived. He is now supervising the entire course of world history while simultaneously preparing the rest of the universe for our future role in it. He always has the best information on everything and certainly also on the things that matter most in human life. We listen to him by aligning our lives with his words. And when we do, we begin to walk with hope and with clear minds and hearts. Second thing that we see in this story is Jesus' words in verse 7. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. From the very beginning, fear has accompanied sin and brokenness. Adam and Eve rebel and reject God and his way, and immediately they hide from God because they're afraid. Fear is part of the human story because of that. Fear of this kind is the result of brokenness in the world. We don't just witness it. We feel it and we carry it. But why does Jesus say to the disciples in this moment, don't be afraid? Well, they're afraid in the presence of God. Fear is an appropriate response to fallen human beings in God's presence. Because he's unlike anyone we've ever encountered in every way. He's utterly unique, otherworldly. And yet there's this significant weight to his presence that makes you aware he's important, holy, set apart. Now, then the disciples in this passage, they fall down, face down in fear. And today, our fears may look different, but that command remains. Do not be afraid. And some of us hear that and it's like, that kind of seems not realistic. What do you mean, don't be afraid? I feel fear all the time. You just want me not to feel fear? It's not what's at work here. Daryl Johnson notes that God's commands are also God's enablement. That when God says, don't be afraid, it's not a guilt trip. It's an invitation, an empowerment to trust. Don't be afraid doesn't equal don't feel fear. It's not about avoiding the feeling of fear. We may feel fear, but we don't have to be ruled by it. Don't let fear govern your life or define your vision of reality. Why not? Because Jesus has come near. Because God sees the injustice and brokenness, and he has come down to do something about it. That's what the kingdom of heaven is about, rescuing and restoring humanity. And this doesn't mean we won't face trials, tests, hardship, suffering, difficulty. Jesus himself says, pick up your cross and follow me. If we're going to be his disciples, this is part of the deal, suffering. But listen to his words in John 16. He says, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. The world here means all systems, human and spiritual, that stand in opposition to God. How does Jesus overcome? Through sacrificial love. He conquers death by dying. He overcomes evil with good. He defeats our failure to love by loving perfectly from the cross. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And now anyone who puts their trust in him, anyone who chooses to follow him, has this promise that through him, you too can overcome. That you will face hardship, suffering, you will face evil, but suffering will not have the final word. Injustice will not write the end of the story. And so, we need to hear that. Do not be afraid, because God has heard our cries, and he still hears them. Do not be afraid because he has seen our misery. Do not be afraid because he has come down to rescue and renew his creation. Do not be afraid because Jesus, God with us, has come near and has made his home among us. Do not be afraid because the kingdoms of evil, death, and darkness could not overcome him. He overcame evil with good. Do not be afraid because he is with you, and through him you can overcome evil too. Do not be afraid because he wants to work through you to help put the world to right. The world to rights. And there's one last part. One last thing that Jesus says, and it might seem like, how does this relate? In verse 9, Jesus tells his disciples, don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. Don't tell anyone until after the resurrection. This moment that they witnessed in this transfiguration wasn't something to be shared until after the resurrection. And we know that the disciples did tell after the resurrection. And that because they did, we're here. Fear and despair didn't win. Jesus rose physically. Over 500 people saw him alive. And his resurrection wasn't the end of the story. It was the beginning of God's new creation. And it took the disciples a while to make sense of this. They needed Jesus to interpret the scriptures to them. We read about in Luke 24. But when they did, they realized that his life, his death, his resurrection were the inbreaking of heaven on earth. That the promise of scripture is that heaven and earth will be reunited as they first were. It's not that we rise to heaven, but that heaven is coming to earth. And Jesus is the linchpin of that hope. Trust in Jesus is what opens the door to that hope and gives us access to that resurrection power. And so, rather than not telling anyone, now we tell, like they did. We tell each other, because we need to be reminded of what it is that he has done in our world and what he is doing in people's lives. We need to tell others who don't yet know the story. Otherwise, how do you think you got here? Someone told you when you didn't know it. Tell what we've seen. Tell what we've heard. What God has done. How Jesus has rescued and restored. How the powers of evil have been defeated. We must tell one another what God is doing. We must tell others what God has done in those who came before us. We need to speak because there's an enemy who wants to obscure the truth, to distort reality, and paralyze us with fear, to live with despair. We need to tell each other and others what God has done through his Son about life, about forgiveness, about mercy, about justice, about generosity, and who he says we are, and how we were created to image him. Words matter. Words shape reality. And the ones we give weight to determine how we're going to live. And we were made for this union with God. That's the purpose of life. Not wealth or success, career or family. Those may be good goals, but they're not ultimately your purpose. You were made for union with Christ. And so the good news is that if you never attain one of those things, you haven't failed at life. You've succeeded if you live united to Christ. That's where justice, peace, and joy are found. But if you hear his words, admire his teachings, and never surrender to him, never entrust yourself to him, never follow him, then you've missed the point of life. You long for wholeness, you long for justice, you want peace, you want healing, you want flourishing, but you're failing to recognize these are only found in union with the Creator, the giver of life. And so if you refuse to entrust yourself to him, you miss the whole point. And if we're honest, there are moments each and every one of us have where we're like, oh, I don't want to surrender to you. I don't actually want to entrust myself. Like, and it might be just a part of life, it might be a day or whatever, but we all do it. And it comes down to, I think, fear. If I surrender, where are you going to take me? Why would Peter resist what Jesus says when he says, I am going to suffer and die? And he's like, no way, Jesus, that's not happening. Well, because he knows, hey, man, I've kind of hitched my wagon to this guy, and I'm not signing up for that. In that moment, he's not willing to surrender to what Jesus is saying because he doesn't think that's actually a very good future. He's not actually trusting Jesus. So Jesus has to confront him. He says, get behind me, Satan. Now, he doesn't say that to us all the time, but there's this tension within us about surrender. Where if I surrender to you, I don't really want to follow where you're going to take me because I have a feeling it's going to hurt. It's going to be hard, harder than I want it to be. We resist because of this fear of the unknown, because we think it's better when we're in control, because we want to avoid hardship. But the thing is, because of who he is, we can trust him. He's actually the safest person we can trust. And because of who he is and what he's done, we can actually know that he will lead us, and it will be hard, but he'll be faithful to bring us through, and there's vindication. That if the Son of God can trust the Father, go to a cross, yes, suffer, but experience vindication through the resurrection, then anyone who trusts in him experiences that same promise of vindication, no matter what we go through. Don't let fear stop you from surrendering to him. John the Baptist, in the story, he surrenders, and it ultimately costs him his life. But John understood that with this king, suffering and reigning went together. That was the way of this king. Jesus calls us to follow him. See, John alone didn't just surrender his life. Jesus surrendered his life for John and for you. Jesus did it for the joy set before him. He endured the shame and pain of the cross for the joy of defeating the powers of evil, the powers of darkness and of death, for the joy of seeing you and I set free from all of it. On the other side of surrender, this is what we lose sight of, is joy, real joy, unending joy. As I conclude, I just want to invite you to think about the most emotionally grounded person you know. I'm not saying someone who never feels or never shows emotions, but someone who feels deeply and yet responds appropriately. Someone who's gone through pain and suffering and yet still radiates joy. Where when they tell you what they've gone through, you're like, you're a remarkable person. I would have no idea because you just seem so grounded, so joyful. I think of someone like that, someone who's been a mentor to me. He's a sensitive soul, the kind of person who feels deeply. He's been through great loss, real sorrow that's marked his life. And he's always been wide-eyed to the brokenness of our world. He pays attention to the pain, to the news, to the stories of those who suffer, and he carries it, and it grieves him. But he also loves Jesus and believes with all of his heart that Jesus isn't distant, but close and near, that he's at work right now rescuing and restoring his world. And so he walks with both joy and with sorrow.
And when that ache rises, when something awful, terrible happens in our world, a story of injustice that crushes him, he doesn't harden. He doesn't numb himself or hide from it. He actually often goes on a walk. And he starts to pray and talk with Jesus. And recently he shared about how he went on one of those walks and he was angry. He was angry at the evil and injustice in our world. And he needed to tell the Lord he wasn't okay with it, that it bothered him so much. And in that place where he's telling the Lord, bringing his anger to him for what is happening in this world, he came to a place where he was just silent. We finally got it out and said it. And in that silence, the Lord reminded him that anger is usually a secondary emotion, and that beneath it is often sadness. And as he made room for that, he started to realize, yeah, I am angry, but I'm also full of sorrow. And there on the walk, my friend began to weep as he saw how much pain there was within him, and tears started to roll down his face. And then the Lord reminded him of the words of his son, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." And there in anger and sorrow at injustice, my friend had this encounter with the one who is both the God of all comfort and the God who in Jesus has come to make all things right. And he was able to turn that place into a place of surrender, where he surrendered himself to whatever Jesus wanted in that moment. And so Jesus began to lead him in praying, with a heart of compassion and hope and a posture ready to do whatever Jesus wanted. And I think something like that is our call as his followers, is that we don't run from grief, we don't numb ourselves to it, but we do not let it consume us to the point where we actually are just walking with despair. We are people who hold it and bring it before him. We confess our anger, but we cling to his words. We listen to him. We hear his words and call, "Do not be afraid." And we tell one another about what he's done. Our world needs it, and we need it as his people. So, Father in heaven, we thank you for Jesus. We thank you that he came to do your will, your good, perfect, and pleasing will, to set captives free, to give sight to the blind, to heal the sick, to bind up the wounded. And we thank you that he laid down his life and overcame evil with good. And that on the cross, he gave us not what we deserve, but what we don't deserve. He gave us mercy. And we thank you that he hasn't just sought to redeem or set us free or to reconcile, but he has come to do that in order to begin to put the world to rights. And so we ask that by your Spirit, you would enable us to be a people who remember and meditate on and dwell on his words, who hear them but also put them into practice, who take what he has done and imbibe it, consume it, and live in it, so that we would be carriers of hope in a broken world that you have come to restore. And we ask that you would help us to be a people, when we feel the grief, not to hide from it, but to bring it to you and have you lead us through it. And we pray this for your glory and our joy. Amen. We're going to take communion.